Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Kevin Sessoms, whose new memoir is I Left It on the Mountain, and LaShonda Catrice Barnett, whose debut novel is Jam on the Vine. They'll both be appearing at this year's Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival. Kevin Sessoms is one of the best-known of American celebrity journalists, and in establishing his work, he became a celebrity himself. You may know his writing from Vanity Fair, Allure, Parade, or The Daily Beast, and he is now the editor of 429 magazine. His first book was the best-selling autobiography Mississippi Sissy, and he's back with I Left It on the Mountain, a memoir. Welcome to The Reading Life, Kevin.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Now, I was interested to see that New Orleans is one of your old stompy grounds.
Yes, I have a pied a terre there for a long time. Is it the LaLaurie House?
Yeah.
I lived in one of the servants' quarters in the back. I love New Orleans. I love it. My waistline doesn't, but my soul does.
No one's does. And then on March 8th in 2008, you were at the Mobar, one of my favorite places, and you began to plan your trip, the trip that's really at the heart of this book.
Mm-hmm. The Camino de Santiago de Compostela. It's a spiritual journey that people have walked for over 2,000 years. I was sitting at Mobar having a hamburger, and then when I drank a vodka, and I'd gotten to the point where I was sort of losing everything in my life. I was still doing drugs at that point, too, and sort of at my wit's end. I read this story in the New York Times about a German writer who had written this book about his walk on the Camino that was much more sort of glib and funny and irreverent. But it was a huge bestseller. And I was in the midst of writing I Left It on the Mountain because one of the ways I had decided to save myself from my own addiction was to write myself out of it.
Mm-hmm.
I had to look at myself and what was the truest version of myself, which was being a writer. So I'd already begun to write the narrative that would lead me to the rooms of fellowship that would help me get sober and to get sober. So I was already beginning to write that narrative. I wasn't at the sobriety part yet, but I knew I would get there. And when I read about the Camino, for two reasons, I liked it. One was I felt the need to do a spiritual trek. And the second was more mercenary. As a writer, I thought it would make a great chapter.
And you got your first advice about walking from the actress Jessica Lange, which I thought was so interesting.
She said that she believes, as I do, in walking meditation. And once I got to the Camino, I really understood it. And I walked for 31 days. I walked over 500 miles. And there's a feeling of stillness that you get once you start that trek. Maybe in the middle of the trek, it begins to happen where you were so in the moment. You've never felt so still in your life, and yet there's such forward motion. There's this weird incongruity that takes place. Jessica told me, the quote from the book is, "That's all I do anywhere is walk, walking for the sake of walking," she told me when surprising me with a phone call one morning after I thought our interview had been completed. But none of that silly walking she wanted, that power walking. And then I asked her what was on her refrigerator, and she had two quotes. One was from T.S. Eliot, which was, "We shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time." And the second one was from Kierkegaard. "Then there's this," she said. It's from Kierkegaard. "Above all, do not lose your desire to walk. Every day I walk myself into a state of well-being and walk away from every illness. I have walked myself into my best thoughts, and I know of no thought so burdensome that one cannot walk away from it. But if sitting still, and the more one sits still, the closer one comes to feeling ill. If one just keeps on walking, everything will be all right.
I know, I love that.
I really believe that. People ask me sometimes, you know, if you could live one day of your life over and over and over like Groundhog Day, what would it be? And I am 100% certain mine would be to walk the Camino every day of my life.
Wow. Well, that's an amazing commitment. One of the things I loved was reading about the companions you met along the way, the actual physical companions, but the intellectual companionship you chose for yourself. The music, for example, I've been listening to the Mississippi Mass Choir on YouTube now with such pleasure.
Oh, my God. There's nothing like it. I first heard them at Jazz Fest, and I thought, thank you, God. You know, it was like, just thank you, God. That's
yeah.
all I thought, thank you, God.
That's the way I felt when I saw them on YouTube, and I'm sure that wasn't, you know, it doesn't compare at all.
Right.
And then you were reading John Keats, which I adored.
Yeah, I mean, I've always been fascinated by him, but, you know, that romantic sort of young death life of his, and I'm fascinated by the close friendship he had with his friend who was with him when he died in Rome. And I even have a Keats tattoo on my arm. It sort of closes the book. The quote is from his Veil of Soulmaking. It's a letter he wrote to his siblings. It's a famous letter. It says, "A proverb is no proverb to you till your life has illustrated it."
So
with,
true.
Sort of a summing up of a memoir.
Well, one of the interesting quotations from Keats that you have in this book is one I took very much to heart, and it was this, "My imagination is a monastery, and I am its monk."
Mm-hmm.
And that meant a lot to me. And it's so interesting to me that you do have this kind of push toward the monkish life in addition to this kind of dazzling celebrity-filled life we all imagine for you.
I tell people sometimes I lead a Cinderella existence, that I'm invited to lots of balls, different kind of balls, but the life I really lead is a very simple one, and I spend most of my time sweeping the hearth. That's how I spend most of my time. So I'm a solitary guy, and I find comfort, I guess, in solitude. I try not to feel too lonely in it, but that's sometimes a problem. But, yeah, I guess maybe that's just the writer's curse. I mean, you've got to be alone to write, and sometimes it bleeds into lots of other areas of your life.
Right? Now, there are a lot of journeys in this book besides your walk along the Camino. In addition, of course, is your struggle with addiction, but you also climbed Mount Kilimanjaro. I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about that.
All right. Well, I was diagnosed with HIV at one point in my life, about a year before Kilimanjaro. And I got a note. I'm going to drop a couple of names here because that's what I do, and I'm accused of it, so I might as well do it. Even the first chapter of this book is called The Star Effer. But right after I was diagnosed, I went to Paris to interview Penelope Cruz. And it was the second time I'd interviewed her. I really liked her. If I were straight, she's someone I'd make a play for. And the way I interview people is I just am open about what's going on in my own life. There's no secrets, really. So I let her know I was HIV positive. And she was dating Tom Cruise at the time. And she told him about that. And he wrote me a note that was sort of his acquaintance also. And in the note, he said how sorry he was to hear about my illness. And I didn't consider myself ill. I just considered myself to have a diagnosis of HIV. I didn't have AIDS. I never had AIDS. And that word illness just jumped out at me and angered me and frightened me. And it upset me that someone would think of me and define me as ill. So when the phone call came from a friend to climb Mount Kilimanjaro, I thought, well, I will show Mr. Cruz and everyone else who thinks of me this way that I'm not ill, and I will climb that mountain and prove that I'm still alive, I'm still healthy. So that was part of it. The other part was I thought maybe if I broke myself down physically by climbing that mountain, I would find some epiphany there of forgiving myself for having converted to HIV late in life, which was tied into my drug use. And I didn't really find it there on the mountain, but what the title comes from is what I'd left there. I don't want to quite get that away. You're going to have to buy the book to find out what I left on top of that mountain.
And it's very worth it.
I left something there.
It's very worth it.
Okay.
So how are you doing now?
I'm a little exhausted, to tell you the truth. I'm launching this book, and it the same time I was launching the book, I was closing the next issue of 429 magazine with James Franco on the cover. It's the conceptual issue, and I pitched the concept to James. The title of the cover story is Straight James Franco Talks to the Gay James Franco, and he's written it himself as if it's a transcribed conversation from a recording of two James Francos talking. So I've been closing that issue at the same time I've been launching this book the past week. So it's a little exhausting. And Mississippi Sissy was a different sort of book to put out into the world because it was almost like writing about a character. Like I approached it almost like a novel. It's written novelistically in a way. That little sissy from Mississippi, to me, was almost separate from me. You know, it was so far in the distance and a sort of a narrative and a story I've lived with all my life that has infused my life, but it was not my life as I was writing it. This book, as I said earlier, I was writing myself out of my addiction. I was saving my own life by writing about it. So this book is really about me now. It's about what I've gone through up until the last 2 years and 8 months of sobriety. So I'm very new at this, and I feel very vulnerable with this book out in the world. And, you know, I've given people the ammunition to criticize me that I weave some celebrity stuff in it. And, you know, some people have a hard time with the fact that I'm writing about redemption and spiritual stuff and dark stuff. At the same time, I'm dropping the celebrity stuff in there and weaving that in. But, you know, if I didn't write about that, I wouldn't be owning who I am in another way also, because that's my day job. I refer to that job, that celebrity stuff. Some people may think I'm too name-droppy and all that stuff, but I look on it like I'm a truck driver. You know, that's just glamorous cargo that I haul. I haul at the deadline. I dump it out. I put some more cargo in it. I get behind the wheel, and I drive that truck. I have a very blue-collar, working-class attitude about what I do for a living. I'm not of the world. I'm invited into that world. I drive that truck through the highways of that world, but I don't consider myself, you know, famous like famous people. I mean, that world needs peripheral people. I'm on the periphery of it. The way I say it in the book is I reside just outside the frame of fame. So I feel vulnerable. But last night I sort of had an epiphany about all of this, which is the impulse to write this book. When I first started to write it, was not only to save my life, but if I wrote it in the vein of service that I was trying to write it in, that it would maybe give some hope to other people and help them save their own lives. If they can see some of their own story in it, if they feel hopeless, that they can find some hope in their own lives and they can find a way to save their own lives in their own way by being the best versions of who they are and help save their own lives, then this book has succeeded. It doesn't have to be on the best seller list.
Right. Books always find their own way.
Right.
We've been talking with Kevin Sessoms, whose new memoir is I Left It on the Mountain. You can meet him Friday, March 13th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop, or Saturday, March 14th at Faulkner House Books at 2. Kevin, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I find it very, very easy to be true. I find myself alone when each day is through. Yes, I'll admit that I'm a fool for you, because you're mine, I walk the line.
LaShonda Catrice Barnett is a short story writer, playwright, and essayist who was born in Kansas City, Missouri. Her first novel is just out, and people are falling in love with it right and left. It's called Jam on the Vine, and it's about a crusading African-American journalist who starts her own newspaper. LaShonda will be one of the special guests at the upcoming Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival and the Saints and Sinners Literary Festival as well later this month. LaShonda Barnett, it's a pleasure to welcome you to The Reading Life.
The pleasure is all mine. Thank you.
I love this book. I especially love books that show strong women characters thinking about their lives and changing the world. So you can imagine how I felt about this book. So tell us about your characters.
Well, Ivo Williams is the heroine of the novel Jam on the Vine. She is a journalist. She is a lover of literature, of reading, of the arts, as she's full of life, and yet at the same time she realizes when she's quite young that the Jim Crow South and the Jim Crow Midwest are not geared to equip African Americans with a life of freedom and a life of justice and a life enjoying civil liberties. So so she takes on all of the foes that I just mentioned with her pen as a journalist.
Now, it's a large historical canvas you're working with here, from Juneteenth in 1897 to a Pan-African Congress in Paris in 1925. Now, you have a degree in American Studies, I know, so that must have been part of the pleasure for you, researching all this history.
That was a tremendous pleasure for me, and I had to often stop myself and force myself to not go into archives because I'm passionate about research. I tell students to this day that going the MFA route, pursuing a Master's of Fine Arts in Creative Writing, is just one of the ways one might go if they are interested in becoming a novelist or a short story writer. I have certainly found that having graduate degrees in history has placed me in fantastic stead when it comes to imagining and filling in the blanks for historical fiction.
Now, you spent a lot of time reading African-American newspapers for background for this book. Talk a little bit about that heritage, which is so large.
Yes, quite large, dating back to the post-Reconstruction era with very early newspapers such as the Richmond Planet, which was founded in 1883, and the Austin Gold Dollar. Oh, there are so many African-American newspapers that were founded in the wake of Reconstruction. And what I noticed when I was in the archives and looking at the newspapers to try to glean a sense of tone was that newspapers tended to go one of two ways. Either they were what historians call accommodationists, so they were espousing a rhetoric, a sort of pull yourself up by a bootstraps rhetoric and tips and advice on how to win respectability. And then there was a different strand of thought in other newspapers like the Chicago Defender or the Boston Guardian, which was more of a militant tone, a very sort of in-your-face ideology about the lack of civil rights that African Americans were facing. Interestingly enough, I wanted Ivoe to experience both. And so when she starts her own newspaper in the summer of 1918 in Kansas City, Missouri, she actually begins in a tone as an accommodationist. She feels that one way that African Americans in Kansas City can win respect is if they dress a certain way, act a certain way. So she's sort of preachy. Her tone is didactic and polemical and preachy, and as a result, the subscriptions really suffer. But by the novel's end, she realizes that it's not a matter of how one dresses or how one carries oneself. Civil rights is civil rights.
And so she changes and becomes a richer character.
She changes. Oh. She begins to take on the Kansas City Police Department. When she gets wind of the erroneous incarcerations of so many African-American men in her community, she begins to take on the Missouri State Penitentiary. And so she grows as an activist herself. And as a result, her newspaper takes on a more militant tone.
Now, there are some real-life figures who inspired you to write this book, aren't there?
Oh, absolutely. Ivoe, the heroine, was based on two journalists who lived. Ida B. Wells Barnett, who was a Southerner, was a Tennessean, when she wrote very important monographs that investigated and exposed the rate of lynching in the South. She wrote two very critical works, Southern Horrors, which was published in 1892, and then she wrote The Red Record in 1895. In addition, she was a journalist for the New York Age newspaper. She was a suffragist, but she's really well known for being an anti-lynching crusader. And then Carlotta Bass was actually the first African-American woman to own and operate her own newspaper, which was the California Eagle, which she launched in 1912 out in Los Angeles and served as its editor-in-chief until 1951. And then she ran for vice president of the United States, a little-known fact. She was the first black woman to run for national office. She ran on the Progressive Party ticket in 52.
Wow. Well, there's a wonderful scene in this book where Ivoe goes into her college's printing shop and, you know, sees presses and does that work. And it shows you so much of the seduction of that as an art form. You know what I mean?
Yes. When I was researching that, I thought, even in our hyper-technological world, whenever new gadgets are introduced, iPhones, e-readers, people really become enthusiastic about the new technology. And the same would have been true even in 1905 when Ivo was matriculating at the fictional Williston College in Austin. And of course, part of the lure for Ivo is because she always sort of envisioned herself as a person who would set type. She goes to college for the printing course to become a person who will hopefully set type for a newspaper. It never even occurs to her that she has a journalistic voice until her college professor, who later becomes her life partner, her lover, and her partner in the newspaper business in Kansas City. When Miss Durden says to her, maybe you should think about writing for the college newspaper and serving as the college newspaper's editor-in-chief, that's the very first time that Ivo has really thought about that. She's very excited about just learning how to set type.
I know. Now, I understand, too, that you wove some family stories into this narrative.
Well, my family originally hails from Burleson County, which is where the first half of the novel unfolds, my grandmother and her seven siblings. And as far back as I can go on my maternal side, all of that lineage is from the Brazos River Valley. And so in that respect, I was very much inspired by my family. But I didn't want to write autobiographically or even semi-autobiographically, which is one of the reasons why I write historical fiction. And so the fact that the Williams family, they make this migration from Texas to Kansas City, Missouri, that's the only biographical information, I would say, that's really in the novel. That is exactly the trajectory that my own family made, albeit later. My grandmother and her siblings came to Kansas City in the 40s.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've also edited the anthologies I Got Thunder, Black Women Songwriters on Their Craft, and Off the Record, Conversations with African American and Brazilian Women Musicians. How has all this music writing influenced your fiction writing?
Oh, that's a great question. I try very hard to endow my characters with very individualistic voices, so much so that when I am writing the narrative, I can withhold directives like Ivo said, or Ona said, or Lemon said, because there's enough personality and enough particular cadence in the dialogue so that readers don't need that directive. They don't need me as the writer to tell them who is speaking. James Baldwin said that he really tried to write like a jazz musician plays, and I understand exactly what he means, and that was foremost in my mind when I was crafting Jam. I was absolutely thinking about a jazz jam session, for example, and envisioning the characters as particular instruments. And so, you know, in a jazz jam session, you have no difficulty discerning when the clarinet plays or when the trombone's going to come in or the trumpet's going to come in. And so I tried to bring that energy and that kind of musicality to my novel.
Well, when you're reading it, you go along and there are passages that are just so beautiful, you just want to stop and read them aloud. And they seem very musical and energetic to me. And this feels like a book where every word was written with love.
It was. I call the book a Valentine to the Black Press because, to my mind, the Black Press is absolutely the most important institution to emerge out of African America prior to the 20th century. I can't imagine how disfranchised, newly freed African American peoples would have been able to form communities and move on with their lives in the name of freedom without the Black Press. So it's a Valentine to the Black Press, and it's also a Valentine to strong Black women who did more than eke out an existence. One of the things that I really wanted to celebrate in this book is the fact that, in addition to sort of the more horrific legacies of the South also gave us things like 94 institutions of higher learning for African Americans. Right after Reconstruction, which is why I go into the story of Ivo receiving her education. There are two or three chapters where we follow the heroine as she's matriculating, because I thought to myself, you know, I don't ever recall seeing a story of an African-American woman who is pursuing her lust for knowledge and a career. And as I started to do the research, I realized that it's well known, but it's little sung about, the rich legacy of historically Black colleges and universities that the South gave us. It's very important to note that most of these colleges were not opened in the North. They were Southern.
And we certainly appreciate that here in New Orleans, as you can imagine. We've been talking with LaShonda Barnett, whose marvelous first novel is Jam on the Vine. You can meet her when she speaks on a panel, Sweet and Savage, Writing the Women of the South, Friday, March 27th at 11:30 at the Hotel Monteleone Queen Anne Ballroom. Saturday, March 28th, she appears on a panel at Saints and Sinners called Historical Outings, Keeping It Real or Making It Up at 11:30. Sunday, March 29th at 11:30, she reads in the Hotel Monteleone Cabildo Room and appears on a panel about LGBT history for Saints and Sinners at 1. Check out TennesseeWilliams.net or SASFest.net for more information. LaShonda, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. The pleasure has been mine.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Laura Kelly reads from and signs The Irish in New Orleans, Tuesday, March 10th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie, and again Wednesday, March 11th at 6 at Maple Street Bookshop. Today's guest, Kevin Sessoms, signs I Left It on the Mountain, a memoir, Friday, March 13th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop, and again Saturday, March 14th at 2 at Faulkner House Books. Poets Megan Burns, Jonathan Patton, and Berent Sauerman read Friday, March 13th at 3 at the UNO Lakeside Campus Liberal Arts Building, Room 197. The Octavia Book Science Fiction Book Club discusses Android's Dream by John Calsey, Saturday, March 14th at 10:30 at Octavia Books. Randy Fertel launches his new book, A Taste for Chaos, The Art of Literary Improvisation, Sunday, March 15th at 2 at the Cabildo. Poet Charlotte Mears reads from and signs her books Sweet Air and Winds of New York, followed by an open mic Sunday, March 15th at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar. M.O. Walsh signs My Sunshine Away, and David Joy signs Where All the Light Tends to Go, Tuesday, March 17th at 6 at Octavia Books. Moira Crone discusses and signs her novel, The Ice Garden, Tuesday, March 17th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Inspired by the old game show Supermarket Sweep, friends of the New Orleans Public Library are having a shopping cart contest. The winner will be able to run through the friend's basement, grab all the books, CDs, and records they can fit in a cart in 2 minutes. Like the Friends of the New Orleans Public Library Facebook page and tag friends in the Supermarket Sweep post at the top of their page to enter. A random winner will be selected and announced March 15th. Start planning now for Edible Book Day at the New Orleans Museum of Art, the annual baking competition for cakes inspired by favorite books. There are several categories: funniest, punniest, most creative, most like a book, best visual presentation, as well as professional categories. Deadline for registration is March 20th. The annual competition takes place March 27th at 5:30 at the New Orleans Museum of Art. Check out NOMA.org for more information. Plan ahead for the 29th Annual Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival, which takes place March 25th through 29th at the Hotel Monteleone and many other venues around town. The complete schedule is up on the festival website, TennesseeWilliams.net. Special guests this year include Williams biographer John Lahr, author of Tennessee Williams' The Mad Pilgrimage of the Flesh, filmmaker John Waters, best-selling author Laura Lippman, Rick Bragg, Amy Dickinson, Phil Klei, Yi-Yun Lee, and playwright Martin Sherman. Don't miss it. The Friends of the Jefferson Public Library will hold their semi-annual big book sale March 26th through 29th at the Pontchartrain Center, Williams Boulevard at the Lake and Kenner. Hours are Thursday through Saturday, March 26th through 28th from 10 to 8, and Sunday, March 29th from noon to 5. This is one of the largest book sales in the New Orleans area with more than 65,000 items for sale. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.